This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Total abgefahren. Bei der bundesweiten Keno-Zusatzauslosung gibt es vom 8. bis 14. Juni jeden Tag einen Audi zu gewinnen und 100 mal 100 Euro extra. Also anschnallen und mitspielen. Keno, die tägliche Zahlenlotterie. In jeder Lotto-Annahmestelle und auf lottobayern.de. Lotto Bayern, nimm dein Glück in die Hand.
Spielteilnahme ab 18. Glücksspiel kann süchtig machen. Hilfe unter bijuk.de.
Total abgefahren. Bei der bundesweiten Keno-Zusatzauslosung gibt es vom 8. bis 14. Juni jeden Tag einen Audi zu gewinnen und 100 mal 100 Euro extra. Also anschnallen und mitspielen. Keno, die tägliche Zahlenlotterie. In jeder Lotto-Annahmestelle und auf lottobayern.de. Lotto Bayern, nimm dein Glück in die Hand.
Spielteilnahme ab 18. Glücksspiel kann süchtig machen. Hilfe unter bijuk.de.
Welcome to Lady Killers with me, Lucy Worsley, where true crime meets history with a twist from BBC Radio 4. This time on Lady Killers, we look at women's rights over their own bodies. We'll dig a little deeper into the parallels between 19th century women and us today. There'll be frustrated sexual desire, legal prejudice, illegal abortion, and slavery. Christiana Edmonds, a lady obsessed, a stalker. The poison that she put into chocolate creams had deadly results.
I was seized with violent internal pains, a burning in the throat, and I was seized with a trembling all over.
Margaret Garner, an enslaved woman who murdered one of her own children. She wanted to free her daughter from a life of servitude.
I would have killed them all, and thus end their sufferings, then have them taken back to slavery and be murdered.
Elizabeth Taylor, a practical midwife who provided women with illegal abortions, sometimes with tragic consequences.
On arrival at Mrs. Taylor's, I was shown into a bedroom where she performed the operation.
And Mary McKinnon, a landlady and likely brothel keeper, she said that she was innocent, but she was hanged on the testimony of a group of drunken men.
I did not have a knife in my hand at any time. I do not know who gave Mr. Howitt the wound, but it was not from me.
I'm joined by a crack team of female detectives to take a look, a feminist look, actually, at the wild and unthinkable crimes committed by murderesses in Britain, North America, and Australia. We hear their words, their voices, and we ask, what drove these ordinary women to do these extraordinary things? What do these lady killers tell us about the world they lived in, about women's lives in the past, and what might they tell us about women's lives today? I'm joined by Aisha Hazarika, broadcaster, political commentator, and feminist. Welcome, Aisha.
Thank you so much. It's such a joy to be here.
Ah, well, you're very, very welcome. Can you tell us, Aisha, a bit about the work that you do?
So I worked in politics for a long time, and I was an advisor on women's issues. I worked for the great feminist politician Harriet Harman, and one of the big pieces of legislation we got in the statute book was the 2010 Equality Act.
What was that like? Tell us about it.
It was a fascinating process, but it was really, really hard work, because it feels like whenever you are questing for more women's rights, particularly in legislation, there is always pushback. And actually, we got as much pushback from men on the left as we did from people on the right of politics as well. You know, we had arguments, for example, about positive action, saying this will be the end of any senior white man ever being able to get a job ever again, for example. We put into the legislation more transparency on the gender pay gap, and people were absolutely up in arms saying this is going to bring the foundations of capitalism down. We mustn't let women start having these conversations, it's going to lead to no good. One of the things that I feel is so interesting, particularly looking at all the cases that we're about to talk to, is that it's so hard to make progress on women's rights. So hard. Every stage in history, any advancement is contested. And yet, it's so easy for the clock to go back.
And here to assess any progress we may have made or not since the 19th century is our own in-house historian at Lady Killers, Professor Rosalind Crone from the Open University.
Hello, Lucy. Hello, Aisha.
Hello, Roz.
Now, we have selected the cases we're here to discuss for the windows that they open into women's lives in the 19th century. And what's particularly interesting to me about the four we're looking at today is that they've all got something to say about women's rights over their own bodies, especially their reproductive rights. Elizabeth Taylor ran her business because women couldn't access safe legal abortions. Margaret Garner chose to kill her own daughter rather than expose her to the sexual abuse that she'd suffered herself. Mary MacKinnon was hanged for, or so it seems to us, standing up for her fellow sex workers. And people thought that it was poisoner Christiana Edmonds's frustrated sexual passions which led to her undoubted crimes. She did actually poison people. Now, Roz, there's been progress towards respecting women's rights over their bodies, I hope. I'm thinking access to contraception and safe abortion since the 19th century. But what was the situation for our forebears in this Victorian period?
Well, the reproductive function of women's bodies, the kind of the incubator, if you like, the deliverer of babies, this has meant that the female body has been a site of contention and debate throughout history. And at times it's been subjected to very strict controls, including in the 19th century. The 19th century was a time when new understandings or ideas about anatomy had come to maturity. For example, that women's bodies, their sexual organs, meant that they were fundamentally different from men and also predetermined their social role as mothers. At the same time, so much emphasis was placed on the family. This was where children were raised, where morals and values were taught, and so substantial effort was then put into controlling women's bodies. So there was the attempt to shame women who had sexual intercourse outside of marriage, to force women into marriage through economic or financial inequalities, including legislation that dealt very harshly with illegitimate children. In marriage, in England or Wales, at least, for much of the century, not only did women have to give their husbands their property, but also their bodies. There was no rape in marriage. We know that many women had good sexual relationships with their husbands and partners. It wasn't a case that sex was just a thing that was done to them, the old idea of lie back and think of England. They were active participants.
Are you saying that Victorian women sometimes had fun in bed?
Of course they did, Lucy.
Who'd have thought it? That's not our popular image of the Victorian age at all. I like it. You're painting a mixed picture of life for Victorian women, but the law, to my mind, was pretty much not on their side. When you were doing your work, Aisha, on the Equalities Act in 2010, what remains of this attitude that men are on top legally?
So many things. I mean, the default position is always, you know, how is this going to affect, you know, men? And I think the thing that's so shocking for me is when I look back on recent changes in the law, Roz just mentioned about rape within marriage. The UK only changed the law on that relatively recently. It was not illegal for, or it was not a criminal act for a man to rape his wife until very, very recently. We still have not decriminalised abortion in this country. You can get legal access to an abortion, but with conditions.
Yes, we learnt that when we were learning about the case of Elizabeth Taylor, and we learnt about some of the problems of backstreet abortions, which that case exposed. That was in Melbourne, Australia. But this has once again become a heated topic of debate, hasn't it, with the overturn of Roe versus Wade in the United States. Let me quickly recap what that is. This is the ruling that made abortion legal in the states in 1973, but its overturn means that individual states can now ban the procedure, making abortion illegal for millions in the US. It's a fiery debate, this is, with some people claiming the rights of the unborn child should take priority over those of the woman. But Aisha, how do you respond to this overturn?
It's so horrifying to think that these really important rights that we all sort of took for granted, and I think this is the the big thing that has sent a shock through women and, of course, men across the world is that, you know, you think these rights are established and then they can be overturned. And what I was really struck by, particularly listening to the story about Elizabeth Taylor, essentially, you know, you hear these stories from history about the absolute dire straits that women found themselves in. And yet these are the stories that are still happening today and will be happening in states across America where it will be illegal to administer an abortion or help a woman get an abortion. It really is an absolutely horrendous situation. I mean, these stories about women having no agency over their bodies, you think this is something from times gone by, and yet it is not.
I think it's really tempting to think, isn't it, that we've moved on since the 19th century. Everything has got better for women. But this is a reminder that history doesn't work like that. Some things get better, some things get worse. Now, Roz, looking at the 19th century, we know, don't we, that banning abortion doesn't make it go away. What was the situation?
The criminalisation of abortion in the 19th century didn't make it go away. It just made it riskier and more dangerous for women's health because it limited the options for getting help when things went wrong. Banning abortion without giving any thought to the consequences of unwanted pregnancies. So, for example, what support mechanisms are in place for single mothers and also large families? Is the state willing to provide financial support, for example, childcare? You know, how do we sustain a larger population and bigger families? The thought process never is there. That lack of state support helps to sustain then an illegal abortion industry. The industry basically becomes this open secret. And those working within the industry illegally, they come to the notice of the law, they are prosecuted when things go terribly wrong.
Now, our next lady killer, Christiana Edmonds, was a woman who, on the face of it, seems unlikely to have dealt with an unwanted pregnancy. We're talking here about a genteel spinster living in Brighton who gets a huge crush on a doctor, a married man, who wants nothing to do with her. But Christiana becomes fixated, becoming what we would today call a stalker, and a very dangerous one too, poisoning people in pursuit of the object of her desire. Now, stalking may sound like a very modern phenomenon, but no, this particular type of it, erotomania, was very real indeed in the 19th century. But female stalkers are pretty rare. What do you make of this whole phenomenon of stalking, Aisha? I hope you haven't had personal experience of it, but I guess as a woman in the public eye, you may well have done.
Yeah, I mean, I've definitely had some quite uncomfortable encounters with, again, mainly men who have, you know, constantly bombarded me with messages. And when I was doing a stand-up tour one year, there was a man who threatened to sort of turn up at one of my gigs. And it was, you know, it was really kind of quite frightening. But what's so interesting about this story is that it's about female stalking. Now, the sort of comedian in me kind of goes, haven't we all been there, ladies, after a couple of glasses of wine late at night?
Before, in my case.
Just let's check up on what the ex is doing on Facebook or Instagram. And then you have that horrible moment that you might accidentally like, you know, a sort of post. So I think there's definitely something in the psyche. And there's probably something in the female psyche. I probably think everybody does it, that probably is guilty of a bit of light stalking, particularly in this age of social media. So there's a kind of funny side of this because we all do it. But of course, there is a very, very dark side and the Christiana story goes there. But we also see it so much in modern life because of the phenomenon of social media. And I think what that has done for people is, you know, you might have had a huge crush on a celebrity, but they were very remote from you. But now with social media, you feel that you have an accessibility to them. You feel you can communicate with them directly, and that often happens. I have a very good colleague who he is a man. I mean, he has had a female stalker, which went from, oh, you know, aren't you lucky, you know, to actually very, very, very frightening in terms of this sort of presence in his life. So I think that sometimes the idea of the female stalker, there can be a very haha, old-fashioned, slightly sexist trope, you know, the crazy stalking lady. But actually, it can get very dark, as we saw from this case.
So continuing our theme of women's bodies and who gets to control them, let's move on to another tragic encounter with the law experienced by Mary McKinnon, whose property in Edinburgh was used as a drinking den and also likely a brothel. And despite protesting her innocence when one of her clients died in a fight, Mary was hanged. Now, Roz, our guest detective for this case, Anastasia Ryan, when we talked about this, challenged the notion that sex workers have always been victims. How much power do you think that a 19th century sex worker might or might not have had?
So broadly speaking, in the 19th century, there were two dominant narratives about prostitution. On the one hand, prostitutes represented a dangerous side to female sexuality. This was sex outside of marriage. This was transactional sex. Some women, they believed, went into the trade because they had an insatiable appetite for sex, a licentious nature. They were fun-loving and immoral. And this represented a kind of potential danger of women being in control of their bodies. On the other hand, prostitutes were viewed as victims, fallen women who had been seduced, trapped in the trade, and so not in control of their bodies. These two narratives are reflected in the approach of the authorities, social reformers who made great strides to control and restrict prostitution, from the criminalization of activities that surrounded prostitution to the Contagious Diseases Acts, where women were targeted in order to treat venereal disease, often against their will, to the establishment of refuges, so homes for prostitutes where they would recover their morality, become good citizens and go back out into the world and not do it again.
So, Ross, 19th century prostitutes were either bad or victims in a sort of strange binary way. And sometimes they couldn't be both at once, it seems.
Yes, according to contemporaries. Now, over the last 20 or 30 years, historians have done a very good job of breaking through these narratives to try to get a better understanding, especially of who undertook sex work and why. Prostitution, for the most part, it was a choice. It was about earning money, supplementing low wages. Basically, they had a poor set of options, limited choice of employment, and this looked like the one to go for. Best of a bad lot. Mm. And within the profession, it's important to say, women had some input. They were part of the shaping of it.
Mm. Which wasn't the case in many other kinds of work, I suppose. Aisha, what's your take on sex work today? What do you think about this whole issue?
It's very kind of fashionable at the moment to sort of say that, you know, sex work is just the same as other work. I mean, I do have a different view on that. I've spent a bit of time talking with prostitute groups, and what's really interesting is that they're campaigning very, very, very hard for more rights, and I completely understand and respect that. But what is interesting is, to me, and what they have said to me, is so much sex work right now, and certainly over the last sort of 10 years, has been driven by poverty. It's been driven by austerity. It's been driven by the cost of living crisis that we're seeing at the moment. I had a discussion with a prostitute recently who was saying that actually the cost of living crisis means that lots of young mothers are turning to sex work. So I'd like to be pragmatic and compassionate towards sex workers. There may be things that the law does have to revisit in terms of women's safety and things like that. But fundamentally, for me, I hate the idea of commodifying women's bodies.
So interesting. I want to start arguing with you, but we need to move on. Now, Mary McKinnon was, until it all went wrong for her, a businesswoman. She was in charge of her own life. And another of our lady killers who assesses her options and who also strives for a better life, actually, is Margaret Garner. Margaret Garner was born enslaved and, the evidence suggests, was cruelly sexually exploited, bearing children that we think were fathered by the man who claimed to own her. She wanted freedom and control over her own and her children's bodies. And in her case, the Free State of Ohio lay only a tantalizing 16 miles away. The danger of her escape, the risks that she ran to find freedom. Ayesha, do you see any parallels for this experience in the world today?
I just think this story is so harrowing. And of course, it's been immortalized in the book Beloved by Toni Morrison. And I think the thing that really struck me is when you hear stories like this, they didn't happen thousands and thousands of years ago. They're relatively recent in our history. And slavery has such a long tail. And we're still not, I think, fully understanding or as a world, fully processing
the legacy of the transatlantic legacy, slave industry.
And there's two elements to that. There is the entrenched structural inequality that we still see today in society, the racism we see, the institutional inequality. But there's also, I think, one thing we don't talk about enough, and that's the inherited trauma of these stories and the slave trade. We have not even, I think, scratched the surface of the deep psychological wounds that I think is still inflicted by slavery generations down the track. So for me, this story, it's horrible. And you think, my goodness, this has happened in the dim and distant past. It's not, actually. And I think we're still seeing the long tail of that horrible, barbaric trade.
The transatlantic slave trade may have come to an end, but slavery certainly hasn't, in the form of modern day slavery and people trafficking. Ayesha, can you tell us, have you had any involvement with the women affected by this today?
At one point, we did a bit of a study in about sort of 2007, 2008, looking at your local newspaper where you would see adverts for a skip, perhaps, or a lost cat. And in the midst of it were basically adverts for brothels which had trafficked women in them all across the country. And actually, you know, we have trafficking and slavery going on, I think, sometimes in our own communities. We turn a blind eye to it. People don't realise that sometimes in suburbia, leafy suburbia, there are brothels where it isn't a choice for many of those women.
Now, in all of the four cases we've looked at, the women get bad press, in some cases well-deserved, we'd argue, other cases less so. And Ayesha, this world of the press is one that you know well as a journalist. How do you treat women that you have to cover as a journalist who you disagree with? What happens when your feminism and your other views come into conflict with each other?
Well, I actually wrote a stand-up show about this a couple of years ago called Girl on Girl, The Fight for Feminism. And my premise was that actually, just because you're a feminist, it does not need to be the case that you agree with every other woman. Of course we shouldn't. And there are many women who I profoundly disagree with, but I respect their agency and they're allowed to have that view. What I think is so interesting is that we never think that men should think the same. Mm. In fact, men are allowed to disagree gloriously with verve and enthusiasm and vigour and virility. And then they're allowed to go for a pint afterwards and then slap each other on the back and actually continue the old boys network. Interestingly, the old boys network goes across the political divides and where men have disagreements. We should be able to say, look, we don't agree on these five things, but actually there's probably quite a lot of things we do agree on in terms of poverty and violence against women and all of these things.
Well, looking at the lives of the women we've covered, these 19th century women, is there anything about their world that we can be jealous of as women living in the 21st century? Is there anything that they got right?
Yeah, what you're touching on there is historians do not like to think of the past as this kind of story of progress, right? The assumption that we're better than our forebears isn't good. But historians are equally distrustful of nostalgia. Now, there are times in my life, I suppose, I've had a little bit of sympathy for the idea of separate spheres, that you divide up your world. You know, men occupy this bit, women occupy this bit. And especially within a marriage, it's quite a neat division of roles, isn't it, where you take on different tasks. But immediately when you start to scratch, you see how terrible that idea actually is in practice, especially when women are given the home, which generally means they don't have any kind of authority You lose that when you don't get to earn the money.
When you think of 19th century society as being stratified, the answer to this might depend on where you fit in into that social structure.
That's exactly right. We could say that 19th century ideas around sexual differentiation, femininity and masculinity, there was some certainty here. And that meant that I think it was kind of easier at times to identify the inequalities in society and then to work to address them. You kind of knew where you had to target things like the vote, things like addressing abortion law, education, work, marriage, political rights. And women made good progress in these things over the 19th century and into the 20th. I think for better or worse, we no longer have that certainty. Legally speaking, it feels like we've achieved most, if not all, of the big battles for women's rights. But equality for women still feels, to me at least, very elusive, or that it hasn't somehow met our expectations. More women work alongside child-rearing, more men are kind of involved in domestic life, but gender stereotypes and expectations continue to shape our lives in important and profound ways.
Aisha, what would you like our listeners to take away from the four stories of these women that we've been looking at?
I think it would be to learn the lessons of history and time. And these four cases, at their core, have actually got issues that we are still battling for today in terms of gender inequality. Extreme poverty, lack of agency, lack of opportunity, women's health and reproductive rights, and violence against women. And it's just a reminder that these things are never set in stone and that the clock can go back.
The story's not over, is it? History isn't over yet.
No, it's very much still in progress.
Now, it's comforting to think that mainly as time goes by, things get better for women. And broadly, I think in terms of reproductive safety and rights for women, that is probably true. But I don't want to assume that everything for Victorian women was dreadful. We need a nuanced view of their lives. And that's why we try on Lady Killers to examine the sources, try to find out what the sources' biases might be, and to do our level best to listen to those really elusive voices of women from the past whose stories haven't traditionally been told. And you know what? I think that these skills of analysis and judgment and questioning the evidence, they aren't just skills for the historian or for the journalist like you, Aisha. They're skills for the citizen. They're skills for any member of the human race. But what I think mainly our lady killers have shown us is a world in the 19th century for women in terms of reproduction that was a bit dark and dangerous. Even if the courage shown by Margaret Garner or even by Elizabeth Taylor is humbling and inspiring. Sitting here in my own body in the year 2023, I'm very glad that in terms of reproductive rights, things have come on a bit since the story we've told in this series began 200 years ago. Well, thank you for joining me, Roz, and of course, you too, Aisha.
Thank you so much.
Oh, it's been a pleasure.
Lady Killers is presented by me, Lucy Worsley, and produced by Emily Hughes. Our resident historian is Rosalind Crone, and our special guest was Aisha Hazarika. The series producer is Julia Habel. It's a Story Hunter production for BBC Radio 4.
From the makers of The Battersea Poltergeist and Uncanny, a new paranormal podcast series from BBC Radio 4, The Witch Farm.
People always say, oh, I'd love to live in a haunted house. They bloody well wouldn't.
The Witch Farm is the true story of an ordinary couple in an extraordinary, terrifying situation.
I don't think I've ever come across a case with this much phenomena.
I call her the Grey Lady. Like a black and white image. There's no colour to her at all.
So you believe that the devil is real?
Definitely.
Leave us alone! Get out of our house!
The Witch Farm. Subscribe on BBC Sounds. Welcome to to Britain's most haunted house.
Total abgefahren. Bei der bundesweiten Keno-Zusatzauslosung gibt es vom 8. bis 14. Juni jeden Tag einen Audi zu gewinnen und 100 mal 100 Euro extra. Also anschnallen und mitspielen. Keno, die tägliche Zahlenlotterie. In jeder Lotto-Annahmestelle und auf lottobayern.de. Lotto Bayern, nimm dein Glück in die Hand.
Spielteilnahme ab 18. Glücksspiel kann süchtig machen. Hilfe unter bijuk.de.